out there, rock and rollers, welcome to the 118th episode of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, brought to you by me, your host, Mac B, the Wolf, from Amsterdam, though I'm no longer in London, and I may not be in Amsterdam all that much longer either, but I still have all of my very favorite bands from England over the years, so don't expect a change in the name. And I will be joined here, as usual, by my co-host, partner in crime from the East Coast of the United States, Gary Action Jackson. And it's an interesting time here on The Wolf, as I mentioned here. We call it the Ugly American Werewolf in London because I lived in London for the last 3.5 years, right off Abbey Road. So happy to be there and all that rock and roll history. Got to see some killer shows after COVID, of course. And then we continued our European journey, moved to Amsterdam. But it looks like the European part of the tour might be coming to an end. We may just be moving back to America here soon. So you have to stay tuned to see where in the world I might be. But don't expect the name to change, folks, because I'm still an Anglophile when it comes to my rock and roll, as is Action Jackson. It's not like we don't like American bands. It just so happens that most of the bands we love just happen to be British, and you can't deny the list of amazing, amazing rockers from over the years. And we still enjoy doing shows about bands that maybe they made it big in the UK, but they didn't make it in the US, or vice versa. And today's show is about two legends who are, in fact, English, who did have great success really on both sides of the pond, and to be honest with you, all around the world. And that's David Coverdale and Jimmy Page, who in 1993 had a collaboration called Coverdale Page at the behest of John Kolodner of Geffen fame and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, who decided they should get together after Jimmy tried to maybe do something with Robert Plant or tried to get a Led Zeppelin reunion off the ground. Didn't work out, so Kolodner's like, hey, I know, Coverdale, why don't you do something with him? This album came out when we were in college. We lived together. We bought the record as soon as it came out. It was all over rock radio with Pride and Joy, Shake My Tree, Take Me for a Little While. It was on MTV back when they showed videos by bands who played instruments and wrote their own songs. The young people today might look that up on YouTube to see what that was like. But at any rate, it was a special time in our lives. And we even bought tickets to see them in concert. Now, that concert didn't happen in the United States. That tour got canceled. We'll get into that on the show. But for all you Zeppelin fans out there, for you Whitesnake fans out there, and we've done shows on many Zeppelin shows. We've done a Whitesnake show with Sonny Pooney last year. I think you'll like going through this one and what we have to say about this one. Plus, it's the 30th anniversary. Came out in mid-March all around the world. And we're hopeful that there might be some kind of special 30th anniversary edition coming out soon. Fingers crossed on that one. In the meantime, I got to take care of a little bit of business here, folks. As usual, we like to mention that we are proud members of the Pantheon Podcast Network of shows, a family of about 100 different shows, almost all music-related and really all genres. There's something in there for everyone. We have had guests on from other shows. We have guested on other folks' shows, like Jay at the Hook Rocks, like Tom and Zeus from the world's number one Kiss show, Shout It Out Loudcast, like our sister, Christy Alexander Hallberg of Rock Is Lit, like our dear friend, Paul Stevenson of This Day Rocks and Vintage Rock Pod, like Martin Popoff of History in Five Songs, and the CEO, Christian Swain, and Rock and Roll Archaeology. And we have to thank our amazing sponsors at RareVinyl.com, an English company, but they ship all around the world. And guys, they've been doing this for 40 years. I know we got a lot of record collectors out there. You like Led Zeppelin? You like Whitesnake? You're looking for something rare from Coverdale Page? Go to RareVinyl.com or to EIL.com. Find something that you love. Use the code PODCAST and you can save 10% off your orders. They have an amazing team. I've been to their warehouse. I've met their record buyers. I've met the whole team. They're great folks. They have a 5-star rating on TrustRadius. They have over 250,000 things in stock. Albums, singles, CDs, posters, tour books, ticket stubs. Whatever you might be looking for, you might just be able to find it on Rare Vinyl. I guarantee you there's lots of stuff. If Easter's coming up, hey, St. Patrick's Day is coming up. It's your birthday. Whatever it is, go to RareVinyl.com. Use a code PODCAST. Save yourself 10%. But back to Coverdale Page. Yes, Jimmy took some guff from using David Coverdale, just because Coverdale had often sounded so much like Robert Plant over the years, including some guff from Robert Plant. And they had to downplay that a little bit in the press. Those are questions they had to answer. And it's kind of part of the whole thing. But this must have gotten Robert's attention, because it was not too long after this that the whole unleaded thing happened. The great DVD, VHS, live album, and then eventually tour that Jimmy and Robert embarked on in 1994. And I think it also went into 1995. So hopefully you'll like this one. This is me and Jackson going through Coverdale Page on its 30th anniversary right here on The Wolf. So should we talk about Coverdale Page, the 1993 album that we listened to a ton in 1993? I mean, a ton in our dorm room in Elizabeth Hall in Winter Park, Florida, 1993.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can we start with the airing of the grievances?
Airing of the grievances. Please, please, let's start that way, because there's always something to bitch about. What is that?
What is this? What is this?
That looks like the cover.
That looks like the cover. What is the cover? The cover is a sign. I guess this is the sign to merge on the highway.
Yes.
That's what this is. Okay. It's literally a picture of a sign with a blue background that looks like clouds.
Correct.
And it says Coverdale Page.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you for nothing.
You know who did that cover, don't you?
Who is that?
That would be fellow Pantheon podcaster Hugh Syme of Music Buzz.
Okay. I don't want to say it was. I mean, if this was the cover, then the rest of it is going to make me upset, because you could take this as an artistic expression.
Right.
Okay. But then when you open it up, I'm going to want to see pictures of the band. I'm going to want to see other stuff.
Sure.
There's nothing. There's this sign again. It's in a wood pile.
Mm-hmm.
It's with some cows. It's in front of the pyramids in Egypt.
I remember that.
Let's see. What else do we have here now? We have it in a car graveyard on the beach, and then out in the middle of the ocean. And that is it. Done.
No pictures of Jimmy or David. See, I'm at a disadvantage there, because I still don't have my records with me. Maybe in the next couple months that'll
change.
That's why
I wanted to get this out of storage,
mm-hmm,
in the vault, and go through it, because I remember looking at this thinking, wait a minute, this is it. There is a cool, like a crest of the C and the P that's on the actual CD. And then if you open it up, it's the first image that you see in here. But then that's it. Like, there's no promotional photos or anything. I don't know whether they weren't available for it or what the deal was. I remember seeing photos later on of the two of them, but there's nothing in this gatefold in this CD.
Interesting. Well, I mean, David must have liked what Hugh did for Whitesnake 87.
That's a cool cover. And actually, this cover wouldn't be bad if they had more stuff on the inside.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options, because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
It could have been iconic if this was the only thing that they used, but they reused it 18 times on the inside of this.
But when you then later see like snakes and arrows or some of the stuff that he did with Rush later on, you kind of see, oh, that's definitely Hugh Syme. Now that I know his aesthetics and stuff, like, that's definitely him. You know, the band was kind of working title could have been called Legends. I think it's good that they didn't do that. I think they also, for a while, were going to call themselves North and South. And I don't know if that, I would love to ask you if that had something to do with influencing that cover, because maybe he was thinking of a sign that had, you know, an arrow going up and an arrow going down. Like maybe that would be both north and south. I don't know. So then my question is, who's the straight line and who's the one joining on the highway?
Well, I know who I would say was the straight line.
I got a pretty good idea who you're going to say too.
And it's not the first person listed, even though that's kind of the way that it makes you think about this. Like, oh, it's Coverdale and Page. No, it's Jimmy Page and the person that he has singing for him on this record.
And he's picked up Peter Coverdale. That's right. Correct. That's right. So correct. What we like to do is kind of go back in time and say, set it up and say, what was going on in the bands or in these musicians' lives this time to create this album? What had they done previously? So obviously in the late 80s and the early 90s, David had huge success with Whitesnake. The Whitesnake 87 album was a huge seller for him. And the follow-up, you know, went platinum, maybe not didn't do quite as well. What was that one called?
Slip of the Tongue.
Slip of the Tongue, yeah. And, you know, and featured Steve Vai, I guess, on there. And stuff. Right. But and David said, that's it. I think I've done for a while. I just made a bunch of money and I'm kind of sick of the music industry and... You know, I'm just going to take a break and I'll probably take a little time off and then decide if I really want to do this for the rest of my life. Meanwhile, Jimmy had kind of emerged from the end of Led Zeppelin. In the mid 80s, he did a couple albums with The Firm, Paul Rodgers and Chris Slade, who was on show 81, and The Frontless Monster.
Tony Franklin,
which kind of missed the mark. I have a greater appreciation for it now, but at the time it was kind of like, well, there's some cool bits in here, but it's just, considering all the talent that's in that band, it really just didn't congeal the way we kind of hoped for, right? So then, you know, Jimmy did the Outrider album, which is a little bit of a mixed bag. It had three different singers on it. It also had instrumentals on it. I mean, including Robert Plant, but then he worked hard on the remasters, which were huge. Obviously, we bought those, the first Zeppelin box set and some of the stuff that came after. Zeppelin did play Nebworth in 1990, if I'm not mistaken, and did Wearing and Tearing off of Coda, which was really cool. And obviously the first time we'd heard that live, I'm like, oh, that's really cool. So you kind of got the idea that Page was gearing up for something. And it sounds like that a Zeppelin reunion was floated. You know, like it would be like a kind of a 10 years later, okay, we've had our time, let's do Zeppelin. I think they're all considering it, except Robert Plant, who is generally the reason why Zeppelin has not gotten back together. It's always Robert. He's always like, nope, I don't need this. And at the time, it was, I think that would hurt my solo career. Like if I, he was still building it. Now and Zen had done pretty well. And so he was still doing that. And he was doing fine at it, honestly. And you know, it's like Jimmy's like, okay, well, okay, now I got to go find something to do. And I saw an interview with him on Finnish television, of all places, on YouTube, he and David. And he was talking about how he was antsy to kind of do something again because he's healthy now. He's not loaded all the time. And he's getting all these tapes of these singers like, none of this is working. None of this is inspiring me. And then once again, it was John Kalodner, A&R legend of Geffen Records, who obviously knew David from the Whitesnake, said, hey, why don't you and Jimmy kind of get together and try something? So like, well, all right, let's meet and see if we even get along, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they went to New York and they met and they kind of hit up a storm. And there's kind of a famous, they decided to walk around New York together and it caused the scene because people know who Jimmy Page is. And he's a bit of a recluse, right? I mean, you don't see Jimmy Page on the streets too much. So, and then David Coverdale with that blonde mane stands out pretty well. And people are like, oh, you're going to do something. You're going to get together, you know, that kind of thing. So that's early 1991. And then throughout the year, both at David's place in Lake Tahoe, where he still, I believe, resides, and down in Barbados, they wrote some songs together. And it started to kind of become this album here. Something I did not know was in that early springtime, their first appearance together on stage was with Poison. To play Rock and Roll. And I'm like, that sucks. That takes it down a big notch in my book, you know.
Well, and I was thinking the same thing, but you got to remember too, like Poison was really big at that point in time, like the early 90s, like right. That was kind of their so I could see how that they would think to themselves, this is a great way to get in front of people because they've got a huge crowd, but yes, those two things don't seem to go together at all.
Did Poison used to do Rock and Roll live, like a cover of it or something like that?
I don't remember that. I do remember that when they did that Moscow Peace and Prosperity concert. Remember that? Like, in they did, I think Sebastian Bach did Rock and Roll with Jason Bonham on the drums. So that could have been one of those things that was like floating around where everybody kind of took a turn.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Well, I mean, you know, that's fine. Look, you're right. Poison was still big at that point, and it was a way maybe they're just in town, like, oh, yeah, we'll go to this show, and maybe we'll just show up and play, and, you know, great for Poison to be able to play with them.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting time that this comes out, though. I mean, this is post-grunge, right? Grunge really takes off fall of 1991. By 93, it's kind of what everybody's doing. And obviously, this is not trying to be grunge. This is kind of more timeless bluesy kind of stuff. Not really trying, but I'm glad that it came out post-grunge, because if it came out in fall of 91 or early 92, I think it would have just been clobbered. I mean, it did go platinum in the US. I think it may have gone platinum in Canada. Sold a couple million around the world and had five singles off of it, so with varying degrees of success. So obviously it was a hit to us because our tastes skew older, and we were just so psyched to have something from Jimmy Page, right?
Well, you didn't, and I was trying to think about this in the context of when it came out, because we got our hands on this when it was new,
right?
And you didn't know anything else about what was going to happen in 1993.
Right.
So I remember when we camped out for those Rush tickets. So what was that, 91, maybe 92?
91.
We were in line with this old crusty dude who had like his whole setup. Like he had a little hammock. He was ready to go. He had done this before. And
that's
so
right.
We just struck up the conversation with him. Okay, what's the coolest, you know, concert you've ever seen? Say, oh man, I saw Zeppelin back in the day. Yeah. And I remember thinking to myself, that's never going to happen. Like that's right. Never going to happen. So when this record came out, I think we were both on the same page with if this is what we're going to get from Jimmy Page, we are going to enjoy this because he will never, ever get back with Robert Plant.
That's right. You know, so like, yeah, let's get it. Let's get Jimmy right away. And
right.
Oh, tickets are going on sale for them to come to the arena. Let's go get some of those. So we dutifully did. We had two tickets to see Jimmy Page and David Coverdale at the Orlando Arena.
Now, when I was looking at this, I was trying to see, you know, that show never happened. But
right.
If it did, who was going to be the opening act?
I don't know.
Vince Neil on his solo tour.
Vince Neil and the Atomic Playboys. I think Steve Stevens was in the Atomic Playboys.
Steve, he was, yes.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other story about how apparently he showed up and there was no music for the Vince Neil solo record. So when you said come and play on the record, you really meant write the music too.
Vince can't write music.
No. But so that would have been an odd show, definitely. Two things that really didn't go together, like Poison and this. And that's kind of what there's a story of. This is a little murky too, because the reason that show didn't happen is a little, there's a couple of different versions of why it didn't happen.
Well, you know, and of course, you know, they had on the drums, they had Denny Carmazzi doing drums, and then they had Ricky Phillips doing a lot of the bass, though. I mean, Jimmy did
some of the bass, and I think had a couple other folks in there. But when they went on tour, they kind of realigned it a little bit, and Guy Pratt became their bass player. And it was supposed to be a tour of their going to Japan, Europe, and the U.S. Well, the Japan tour went off, and they did like 6 or 7 dates. I don't know if Jimmy was dying to do it, but David's like, come on, we got to go do this. And so they did. And there are bootlegs of those shows, and you can see some of it on YouTube. It's a pretty cool set list, which we can talk a little bit maybe at the end of the show. But they went and canceled because I think Jimmy was okay to do theaters, but David thought that was a step backwards. It's like, no, right. You're in Led Zeppelin, I'm Whitesnake, we're doing the big shows, we're not going to do that. So, like, okay, we book arenas, and I just don't think it sold that well. I mean, it sold to us, but it didn't sell to enough other people. So they canceled it. They canceled the European and the American tour. And it wasn't too long after that that Jimmy got the call from Robert's people saying, hey, we've got an offer to do MTV Unplugged. It's like, okay, well, what if we did our own thing? Mm-hmm. Which, of course, became Unleaded, which was super duper huge, important to us in a lot of ways. So then this kind of became a bit of a dead issue. It's like, we're going to try this. We're going to go out. Okay, going on the road. We're going to give it a shot. Yeah, record company's behind us. Okay, yeah. And then it's straight over. It's straight up over. And I don't know if it was Robert saw how... I mean, look, this wasn't a 5 or 10 million seller. This did pretty well. It wasn't fantastically successful. But I wonder if he saw it. Jimmy can do things, and he is in good shape now. Maybe it's time to go ahead and rekindle that fire a little bit.
And I wonder, too, I always thought about this. When they got back together, was Robert Plant thinking of all the people... of all the people that you could have done this with, you pick the one dude who basically has been accused of ripping me off his entire career. I don't know whether that made him upset. Like, are you trying to go around me? I don't know what he was thinking. And then the story of them getting back together is also a little murky, where it's like, Jimmy says, oh no, they invited me to this Boston show. And Plant said, I didn't know he was going to be there at all. And he just showed up. Okay. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, a little, he said, she said, it's also a very English thing to do. It's because, oh no, that's not what happened. Here's what happened. Like, yeah, sure. It is. Here's the thing. I used to, cause I remember Plant going on at the Letterman show around that time, you know, and Letterman asked him something like, you know, you still cling to some of your Zeppelin heritage. She goes, yeah, but I don't cling as hard as Jimmy Page does, or something along those lines. Like, you know, I don't try to relive it the way Jimmy Page does. And you kind of got the ooh from the crowd, you know, when that happened. It was obviously a swipe at Coverdale. And in that same Finnish interview, they kind of at the end, David's kind of like, I really don't know where this came from. You know, for a long time, Robert was an honored guest at my shows, whether it's Purple or early Whitesnake, which was a pretty bluesy kind of outfit before it became the kind of glam rock thing that it did in the late 80s. But it's like, you know, we were friends, nice things to say. And then after I took off and had all this success in the late 80s, that's when the nasty comments started to come in. So I don't really know what that was about. Of course, Jimmy was kind of defending David. It's like, well, it's very short-sighted of Robert to say that sort of thing and trying to be a little bit diplomatic while sticking up for David. Back then I sided with Jimmy Page. I'm like, screw you, Plant. You've been making plenty of stuff on your own. We want to see Jimmy Page. You don't want to do it with him. That's fine. You can't tell him not to do it with someone else. And David was available and just buzz off. Now I go back and listen to it now, having a much deeper understanding of the Zeppelin catalog and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, there are some times on here like, that sounds exactly like Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin. I mean, exactly. And sometimes you can't help that you sound a little bit like somebody else.
Right.
But this was like, I mean, it was like you were trying, because that's exactly the way they captured it. So now it makes more sense to what Plant was saying. Like, I get it now. Because every time Kingdom Come would sound a little bit like, oh, you mean Kingdom Clone? Or Whitesnake's got a little bit, oh, you mean David cover version of Like Snake? And he always had all these cute little names. It's almost like Donald Trump that way. But I was just so happy to have Jimmy back in good shape, sober, and playing some pretty good guitar. It's a mixed bag, this album, a little bit. But there's some really great Jimmy stuff on here.
Yeah, yeah. There are some gems. And there are some songs where maybe you could have left it off. Or the other thing is, when you look at this, let's see, what is the...
It's a long album. It's like 61 minutes.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff you could have trimmed off of this thing. There are a couple songs where, okay, we get it. Let's Let's move on here. Oh, we're gonna go for another 2 minutes on this thing. Holy Christmas. Yes, they could have definitely tightened things up and maybe left a track or two off of this thing. If this was like 40 minutes, 42 minutes, this may have been sounded a lot different.
Or maybe even 50. I mean, like all the singles, it seems like they had shorter versions of them, of the five singles. You know, they would take a minute off here or 2 minutes off here or something like that. Plus, of course, there's a few songs that didn't make the album that we can talk about.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Deborah Bonham.
And I am the Irish werewolf in England, Peter Bullock.
And you're listening to the Ugly American Werewolf in London.
Starting off with Shake My Tree. Good way to start the album, man. You know, it's a very precise kind of acoustic electric thing that Jimmy's going on there, but I liked it.
This was not the first song that I heard. I think the first single was Pride and Joy.
Right.
And so I remember like, okay. But when this came out, that riff at the beginning, I just said, I'm buying this record now. Yep. Jimmy's back. It sounds great. The song is, it's a little long. But that riff is fantastic. I guess he had it kicking around for a while.
Yeah.
It was, and I think it was in those Zeppelin days, In Through the Outdoor.
Right.
And whatever. And then I guess he brought it to Paul Rodgers for the firm, and Rodgers didn't really like it.
Yeah.
And so they didn't use it. And then Coverdale heard it and it's like, oh no, we're definitely using this.
And it's a good song, you know? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And David's got his very raspy, you know, voice here. Kind of builds up to that minute 18 mark when the heavy riff comes in, because you're kind of doing the acoustic groove thing. And then,
I don't want to be your slave. You're trying to drive me to a grave. All I ever hear is that you're living real for me. But all you ever do, baby, is shake my tree. But you keep on pushing, baby, like you never ever been in love before.
But he's doing some early Robert Plant stuff there. Kicking Down My Door, when he's singing that bit, that sounds exactly like Plant, you know. Now, do you hear a little harmonica on this, or is that Jimmy? Is that Jimmy giving a little bit of that kind of When the Levee Breaks guitar?
It definitely sounds like a harmonica. He's credited with harmonica, but it could be. I don't know.
He is on the fourth song. I'm not sure if it's this song or not.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there definitely is a harmonica sounding thing on this track, and you know, going back to Coverdale sounding like a plant in this. On this record, was that maybe Kolodner pushing him? Because I mean, you know, it's a good idea, but you have to sell records. And at this point in time, Whitesnake's not really selling. So do you kind of push it for more of the Zeppelin sound? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I mean, I think it's the fourth single overall, the second in the US, maybe. Some of it's a little bit murky, but I mean, look, we listen to rock radio, we don't listen to pop radio anyway, and they would definitely play this. But look, it went to number 3 on the mainstream rock chart. I'm not sure about the Billboard overall, but mainstream rock, that means people like you and me who listen to rock and roll, they heard it, it was out there. And look, it's a killer way. It's kind of like, okay, we're off and running here. We got a little something going here, Jimmy. You know, welcome back.
And they did play this live when Plant and Page got together.
They did?
They did, yes.
Ah, see, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, because I remember when they started into it, I said, well, that's interesting, because I would have thought that Robert Plant wanted this thing dead and buried. But to play that, they played this and they played Calling to You, I think, from Fate of Nations.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this was like the two, like, hey, here's our solo stuff we're throwing in. But I was very surprised when they went into this.
Yeah, I kind of recall that now, because we didn't get the set list beforehand like we can now. So we show up and you wonder what they're going to play. No, I remember that. You're right. It did kind of take me back like, are you sure? That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to hear it. I'm just surprised that he would have even acknowledged any of this material.
I know. All right. So second song, Waiting on You.
Mm-hmm.
This is another big, heavy riff. But David Coverdale is doing a little more of his bluesy thing a little bit more. It's more like it's Whitesnake. It's more Whitesnake to me.
Yes.
But without the glossy 80s sheen all over it, more of a back to blues post grunge, you know, I think Coverdale is good doing Coverdale. He doesn't need to do Robert Plant.
I made a note on that on Shake My Tree where I don't really like it where he's screaming.
I know. It's unnecessary.
Yeah, this suits his vocal stylings more, this song.
My heart is breaking, my whole life is shaking. Everywhere I turn, I know this love is gone by me. I'm waiting on you. No matter what you do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
More of a blues. If you use that raspy blues voice of his, you know.
Yeah.
And Jimmy isn't overworking here. You know, the solo isn't special. There's a little starting and stopping in the middle, which is a little off-putting, and it also seems unnecessary. I don't love this one. It's a little interesting to me that they put this at number two. But obviously they must have liked it. So good for them, I suppose.
How long is this one? Let's see. This is, because I had a note that this one seems kind of long also. Yeah, it's 5:16.
Yeah, they're all a little long. I mean, there's only 11 songs and it's 61 minutes long. So except for maybe Pride and Joy, they're all a little long, it seems to me. I mean, their compositions, I get it. And some of them are kind of orchestrated, but yeah, I'm with you there.
But see, the problem is, like, if you go and listen to those old Metallica songs, like from the first three records that are like 7 or 8 minutes long, there's like a middle part of it where it's almost like a different, like they go into it, it fits into the song, but it's a different part of that. They don't have any of that here. This is like the same thing. Okay, we're going to do the refrain again.
All right.
Right?
It's just longer. Yeah.
Yes.
And look, Take Me for a Little While, the third song, which was a pretty big hit for them, it's over 6 minutes long. Now, I remember Coverdale saying that MTV thought it was too gothic and they didn't play it that much, but I remember seeing it on MTV.
It was in pretty heavy rotation. They had some effects there that are not very special.
You mean like the foxy girl who turned into a centipede or a lizard or whatever? Yeah, no, that was... I mean, it's like
ball floating around.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Like, pretty girl, awesome. Good thinking. Put her in the video. But sometimes she's a lizard and sometimes she's a centipede. Yeah, I don't really get it. But I mean, obviously a big stage, big set, you know, looks like it's in an old castle or something like that with a big long table. And Jimmy's got that acoustic guitar, which on top of it has something else.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out, there's got to be a name for that, but I don't know what it is. But it was freaky to look at. I'd never seen anything like that before in the intro part.
I know.
And then it, you know, when he goes into it, it morphs into a Les Paul. And I just remember thinking that was really cool because, you know, now we're getting into the heavy part. And Jimmy looks good in the video. He's got the cool looking coat on and the black hair. Yeah. It just... Because I remember thinking that too, like, man, it's been a while and I know he's had a rough ride. And then I kind of remember, I remember it coming out, I remember the cover, but this was the first time I'd seen him in a long time and he looked really good in this video.
He did, you know, he had the cool elevator kind of going up while he's doing his solo or whatever. I don't know. I do think that this is some of Jimmy's best playing on the record. You think in 93 when grunge was all the rage and Metallica was ruling the charts, this is almost easy listening.
Now my days are growing cold. All the memories unfold. Thinking about the friends we lost. Wondering how to count the cost. Now my days are growing cold.
Almost, you know.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah. And apparently it's from losses that they both sustained in their lives that they could kind of relate to. So it's like, all right, there's a little bit of a heaviness there. There's a little bit of grandioseness to the song and the way it builds in some place, the way that the guitar solo builds. It's actually, it's a guitar solo that makes sense within the confines of the song. Obviously, sometimes Jimmy is pretty sloppy. It's kind of like, all right, well, I mean, it's cool, but it's just basically a blues run, Jimmy. But this actually fit the song perfectly.
Yeah. And it sounds, yeah, like you're right. The playing that is more crisp, like you can hear each note instead of, yeah, sometimes he just kind of wanders all mm-hmm. over the place.
But this one was pretty well put together pretty tightly considering it's over 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
Still a good song. Still like that one. And it's cool that Gavin put the money into the video as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Okay. Because yes, that meant that they really wanted to push this thing and they wanted it to be a hit. And I think you're right. Had this come out in 1991, it would have been laughed at because that's not, you know,
it's not Nirvana. Yeah. Exactly.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. So in 93, this was kind of a nice change of pace where it wasn't just like doom and gloom all the time.
That's right. You know, and David tells a story about he was sitting on the video shoot, you know, doing something and talking about ideas he's had, stuff like that. And some woman who, you know, who worked at Geffen is like, oh, David, MTV and videos have changed since you were on MTV. He was like, I'm still fucking on MTV, bit, you know, kind of, but it showed, you know, there was new people at Geffen because I don't know if Geffen had already sold it with the huge success he'd had from like Aerosmith and Nirvana and all that money he'd already made from it. I don't know, but he said there was change afoot at Geffen. And obviously it was like the grunge people were in charge at that point, and like you're an old dream kind of thing. But that's okay. Because the Pride and Joy was also a video where they kind of started off in the studio and you see them kind of jamming in there, those guys. And mm-hmm. then there's also like a big wet, you know, movie soundstage kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where they're performing the song, if you will. But that's a dulcimer to start this thing out with, right?
Yeah, this is another one too, where this was the first single. And I remember thinking, well, this is an odd choice for the first single because it works, but it sounds just that riff at the beginning is just not hard enough, I wouldn't have thought, to lead this thing off.
I like it. It's kind of cool. It's melodic. And then when they come in with that big riff comes in, then you're like, okay, now I'm here. But, you know, once again, Coverdale is doing a bit of a plant thing on this. You know, if you're looking for where does he sound like Robert Plant, here's one for sure.
Yeah.
Also, I think we knew it was a single. It's the shortest song of the album by far, only like 3.5 minutes or so. Also, Jimmy squeezes in a lot. I mean, he plays the dulcimer, which he hadn't done in a long time. He plays the harmonica, which allegedly he hadn't done on a record since 1965 or something like that.
Yeah, because the Zeppelin stuff was all Robert Plant, right? Playing the harmonica?
For the most part, that's the way I understand it, yeah. So, but, you know, it is a very Jimmy kind of song. Like, it's he's got the different tracks. He's got it layered with different acoustic, you know, guitars driving the song. I'll tell you one thing in the video that was kind of weird is that there's this one or two shots where you see him from behind and he's kind of engulfed in smoke or fog.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he's got the double neck, but he's got his back turned to you and he's a little far away. So, you know, you can't see it. And maybe it was because they didn't have the red Gibson. It was a different, maybe it was a white one, or it was a different make or something like that. And they didn't want to show it. Or maybe they're just kind of teasing you. and then at the end, he's definitely using some of that when the levee breaks. Guitar sound. These things. That's the harmonica again, right? I'm like, I don't think it is, because they show him playing the harmonica during the harmonica bit. During the other part, he's playing the guitar, so I don't know if he's got some kind of cool when the levee breaks pedal, you know, or effect or something like that. But this did really well. Number one on mainstream rock. Anytime you get a number one hit, even though it's not the Billboard main charts, anytime you get a number one hit, that's a big deal.
Yeah, and I think that propelled it into the consciousness of everyone. I was surprised it sold a million. And then I wasn't. I don't know. It was because I remember it on the radio. I bought a copy. And so when I was looking at sales, I didn't know, like, this could have been 400,000 or it could have been a million. I don't know. Just because what was the record buying public doing in 1993? So I was happy to see that it hit a million. And anytime you sell a million records, that's nothing to sneeze at.
Exactly. You know, and I mean, it did better than Outrider did. It did right. better than the Firm albums, I think, did. They may have gone platinum, but I don't know. It definitely had more push behind it.
Mm.
And yeah, and this just shows Jimmy is playing precisely. He's not just, you know, the just sloppy, making the cool riffs and stuff like that, sliding up and down the neck. He can really do acoustic stuff. He can go back and forth. So this was a big hit for them and got it on the radio. And so I'm glad that that helped propel the record into people's brains.
Right.
But the big shift now is for Over Now.
Mm-hmm.
I remember back in the day, we really liked this one because it's got, it's kind of got this big fat Jimmy riff on
yeah.
it. And it's good to kind of take a break after some of the faster ones. And David's like, this is dark and malevolent. I like this. And then he worked in the lyrics that I guess it's about his relationship with his wife at the time.
Yeah. Which
party favor, Tawny Kitaen. Great groupie.
I can hear that. This is actually probably, as far as the lyrics go, this is probably my favorite ones that he puts together. Because a lot of his stuff is just, you know, I think a lot of Coverdale's lyrics are just kind of go along with the song. Like, let's just put rhyming words together.
And this they're kind of cliche, yeah, most of them, you know.
This yeah. one really seemed like I've got something to say about this. And I wonder, too, if Shake My Tree was also about Tawny. But yeah, this, when you listen to some of this, it's like, oh yeah, this is kind of nasty. We're really turning the knife into whoever this person is.
Right, you know, it's not just like she was my girlfriend for a few years. They were actually married. Not to mention, as we talked about on our show with Sonny Pooney last year about Whitesnake 87, she was synonymous with the band because mm-hmm. she was in all those 87 videos, and then I think a little bit of Slip of the Tongue as well. So she was an important part of that band. And so when the band is like, okay, the band's breaking up, I'm putting them on hiatus, it's done. He was kind of breaking up with Tawny at the same time. Shouldn't have married her. It's fine if you want to hang out with her for several years, but you don't marry that girl.
Yeah.
Right?
And there were some other issues too that she may have had with other people. I think Chuck Finley said she tried to kill him with a stiletto heel one time. So I think it's one of those where what you love about her is going to kill you.
And she dated OJ. I mean, she's got a pretty long list going on there. But of course, the rumor at the time was, because we lived in Orlando, we had tickets to the arena.
Mm-hmm.
They canceled the show. I guess we didn't realize they canceled the whole tour. The rumor was because she was filming The New WKRP in Cincinnati in Orlando. It's like, okay, well, they canceled the show, so she couldn't show up and come in there. I'm like, well, okay, A, they canceled the entire continental tour. B, they could have kept her out of there. It wouldn't have been hard to do.
Yeah, I think that was the cover story for that. Orlando's a big city. It's not like you would have to run into someone that was convenient.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, when you listen to this, I don't know. I don't remember Jimmy having a big breakup with anyone, like, not to this degree. So yeah, I think this was all about David and Tawny's.
Yeah, Jimmy's pretty good at keeping his private life pretty private. He always has been. Did you ever see that new WKRP?
If I did, I don't remember it.
Yeah, I never did either. I mean, she was still smoking hot back then. Good addition. Good for like the Lonnie Anderson kind of role. I would love to get the WKRP stuff, the originals, on DVD because I'm sure the songs, it's like Miami Vice, the songs they play must make it so expensive that if you can get those DVDs, you need to hold on to them, kind of a thing, you know. But no, I liked Over Now, you know, and it's a nice change of pace. Jimmy's face melting thing at the end wasn't as cool as his Led Zeppelin days, but it was a little reminiscent of the Led Zeppelin days, I would say.
This is another one that's probably about maybe a minute too long. You know, it's okay, we got it, let's go. There really is no mid break point in this thing, so it's just another refrain of, oof, okay, let's move on.
Yeah, I mean, they may have put this out on tape, but I don't think there's any way they put this out on LP in 93. Vinyl was completely dead at that point. I could be wrong, but we obviously only had it on CD. Next, Over Now was 5, so Feeling Hot is 6.
Okay.
Jimmy called this a real fun rock and roll number. They actually closed with this when they toured Japan.
Okay.
So they must have liked it. And it is an upbeat kind of, here we go. The boys are feeling hot tonight.
Yeah.
I don't know if it fit in 1993 with women to the left and women to the right. But that frantic pace led to a kind of rockabilly solo from Jimmy on this one.
Yeah, I have blues solo question mark. And then is he's playing something else? Is that a Telecaster? It sounds a little twangy. Yeah, other than that, I wouldn't really like this song. This is kind of a generic Whitesnake-y sounding song, but that saves it. And I like the fact that the bass is kind of walking up and down too. A lot of the bass on this record is just following along with the bass drum, which I don't like that at all. I think if you hire a guy to play the bass, let's go and get him a separate part.
Yeah, maybe he's intimidated, like, oh, I'm working with Jimmy Page, and you know, Jimmy's in control of all that. And if he doesn't like what I'll play, he'll just play the bass himself, you know. So and Jimmy does play bass on a track or two on here, so that can happen. Yeah, the kind of whoa, that is very cheesy, and it's obviously written for arenas to have like a crowd response. It's kind of silly. Yeah, I mean, it would have fit in good with Whitesnake's catalog. It doesn't fit in with Zeppelin's. I think Jimmy's jamming pretty well here on this one. It's a frantic, fun, upbeat rock song. Would not have made a great single at the time, but I understand why they wanted to play it live. All right, moving on. Number 7, Easy Does It, which was a B-side to one or two of these singles, which was most everything so far. Of the first 5 songs, 4 of those are singles. It's just Waiting on You was not. The 5th one is coming up, which is Take a Look at Yourself. This is 100% ripped off of Led Zeppelin. It is a meld of That's the Way and Rain Song. You put those two together, and that's exactly what this is. Apparently about celebrity life, and it's a nice song, but it's, for me, it's too derivative. I can't hear those other songs while I listen to it. Yeah, not hear the other songs, I should say.
And there are a couple of themes in this record that come, like a couple of like the drum track parts. I'm like, well, you reuse this over again. Yeah, this is you listen to it, you're like, oh, that's I like this song. Wait a minute, I've heard this before, and you're right. Then you go back and you're like, oh, I know where this came from. Correct.
Yep.
But you can't rip yourself off, so no problems there.
I guess, yeah. I'll take you anywhere the four winds blow, and then boom, halfway through, it's a different song.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it's a hard rocker, right? It's cool. It's kind of like you had two things you wanted to do with the same riff. But, you know, for the most part, it went back to the chill part. Another, you know, 6-minute song, it's like, yeah, this is a little long. I mean, it's kind of cool and all, and I do like what Jimmy's playing on here quite a bit. But again, A, it's derivative. B, it's long. And C, it's trying to be a couple things, and I'm not sure. I think I like it, but I'm not sure that it works 100%.
And then, you know, again, it's a 61-minute record. Something you could have trimmed a little bit of fat off of here.
Absolutely, and there's going to be some that we're going to get to. happy trip. But this is one that I will listen to because it is interesting to me, and it's like it's either, what would you rather have? Would you rather have Coverdale sounding exactly like Plant? Would you have Jimmy sounding like himself in Led Zeppelin. I'll take the latter, and that's kind of what this one is to me.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Christy Alexander Hallberg, author of the novel Searching for Jimmy Page, and you're listening to the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast.
Now take a look at yourself. Apparently there's a few different versions of this one. I call this the fifth single, even though I don't think it was the last. It wasn't the final single, but it was released as a single in the UK and maybe parts of Europe, but not really here, not really in America. I guess it's one they wrote together. They wrote it in Tahoe, in Lake Tahoe, and then again, they went to Barbados. They said the tempo changed once David started to add lyrics. I'm guessing that it made it slower.
Okay. This definitely sounds like this could have been another Whitesnake song. And then you get into that, you know, the first thing in the morning, the last thing in the night, I just want to hold you tight. Like, these lyrics, stop, please. This was sappy. I mean, I think if you could have reworked some of these lyrics too, it might have hit a little harder. Some of these things, it's just like, we didn't have lyrics, so let's just put something on. These words rhyme, do it. Throw it out there.
I mean, there's a little orchestration here, but I mean, you know, I have the same note. This is more late 80s than 1983, you know, and the solo wasn't memorable, and it's kind of a cheesy song overall. Honestly, this, you could take this off. I can't believe this is one of the five singles. I'm embarrassed for Paige to be a part of this song, to be honest with you.
First thing in the morning, last thing at night, I just want to hold you, babe, make you feel alright. When the sun is shining, or the sky is filled with rain, wherever we may be, I'm gonna make love with you again. Now I don't need...
Now he did come with me with Puff Daddy, not too many years after this, and I was embarrassed for that, but I kind of understood that better because it wasn't for me. You know, I'm not going to buy it. I'm not glad you're doing that, but to get to a new generation through hip-hop with one of the biggest artists in the world, I get that. I understand it. I don't like it, but I get it. It makes sense, whereas this one's just like, eh. Now, apparently, there's like, you know, because they have like a 12-inch single or a CD single where you can have four songs on there. And so there's a pure acoustic version where there's not the big riff in it. It says there's a version with girls. I don't know if that means there's girl backup singers or there's girls doing something in there. I don't know. I didn't really look that hard because I didn't really want to hear it, to be honest with you.
There are notes in here about them reissuing this or having a plan to do it. I haven't seen anything about that. I think this was probably kind of one of those COVID projects that was kicking around like, hey, what else can we do with the unreleased stuff and some of these other, you know, B-side tracks included. I have not seen anything about that come to fruition.
Yeah, so 2 years, I mean, it's about 2 years ago, like almost to the day as we're talking here, Coverdale was talking about he wanted to do a reissue. He wanted to do a 30th anniversary issue, and he got the rights from Universal Music. He owns it now. So there's some songs that weren't released. There's some different versions of songs. If there's live stuff, I would die to have a live album from that, because that looked like a killer set to me. I mean, look at this. You know, I mean, they do mostly covers. So they do 18 songs, but if you make White Summer, Black Mountainside all one song, which Jimmy did do that kind of all at once live. But so they do 18 songs. Eight of them were from this album, but 10 of them were from Whitesnake and Led Zeppelin, with only three of them, I believe, being from Whitesnake. But get this. I mean, this Absolution Blues, Slide It In, which is obviously Whitesnake, Rock and Roll, Over Now, Kashmir's Fifth, right after Over Now, then Pride and Joy, Take a Look at Yourself, Take Me For a Little While, then In My Time of Dying, Here I Go Again, White Summer, Black Mountainside, Don't Leave Me This Way, Shake My Tree. Then they come out and do Still of the Night. You think Jimmy pulled out the bow for Still of the Night?
I would hope so. Come on. I mean,
that would be cool. Yeah. You know, and then they do Out on the Tiles, Killer, Black Dog, The Ocean, and then, yeah, they end with Feeling Hot. I would love to have CDs, even a DVD of any of that. Plus, Guy Pratt was playing on it.
Right.
So, you know, the bass would be better. God, it would be awesome. So, now, I'm for it. I hope it happens.
I would say the same thing too, because I would love to see that concert. And the interesting part is, I was to do this, I'm like, well, I could pull the CD out, but it's kind of a pain. I'll just look for it on Apple Music. It's not on Apple Music, like anywhere. Like there's a
it's on Spotify. About it.
Oh, is it on Spotify? Okay, so yeah. I didn't know if he was messing with the rights or what the deal was, but yeah, I found it interesting. They had nothing on there other than a narrative of what happened.
Yeah, no. So I mean, I don't always buy. Oh, look, it's the 30th anniversary. Like, yeah, great. You know, you're cleaning up something that wasn't all that great. But if you really got all the bonus stuff, and you really got, I don't know if they would get that whole concert or not, but I would love to have the whole thing. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. They might have to trim some of those songs out. And pick the ones, you know, and I hope it wouldn't just be, we'll give you live stuff off Coverdale Page. I would hope they would do a little bit of the Zeppelin and a little bit of the Whitesnake stuff. So,
right.
We'll see what happens this year. For the ninth song, Don't Leave Me This Way, apparently the guitar part was something that David had written a long time ago, like maybe back in the Purple days or certainly the early Whitesnake days. But he, you know, it never really saw the light of day. He showed it to Jimmy, and then Jimmy helped do something cool with it. So he likes this one. But I don't think there's much to it until Jimmy really does. I feel like I can tell the opening bit is something that almost anyone could do, and a guitar mm-hmm. player could come up with. And then there's a little bit more that Jimmy kind of takes back the other one. Like, I bet that's what Jimmy added on here.
I don't want to win, but I don't want to lose. I don't want to be alone. No more, no more.
It's a little slow, but I like it better than the last one. I like it much better than Take a Look at Yourself.
Yes. Yeah. This is, it's blues, but it's almost 8 minutes long. Oh
yeah.
They're trying to sound like Zeppelin. I get that. That's fine. You know, at this point in time that you figured out that's what this record is going to be. And then I have, Jimmy is just wailing at the end of it. So I think you're right. I think he came in and said, okay, that sounds okay. Let me put my touch here on the end of this.
Yeah. I mean, it does drag a little bit. Yeah. It's like 8 minutes long, but the typical solo on this album is, it's very bluesy. It's not very memorable. I think you're right. It gets better at the play out at the end. He's doing some cool stuff then. But the solo, there's really not that much to it. And I do think there's a lot more Robert Plant mimicry going on this one. And I understand you want to have a song that you can stretch out, make it a blues one, mm-hmm. give Jimmy a chance to noodle and shine and do different things. But like 8 minutes is a long time. I think they did. Did they play this live? Yes, they did. Yes. Yes, they absolutely played this live. So, you know, it was intended for them to go out and jam on it. It's a jam. So,
if this was written that, or the, if this started that long ago, like in the Deep Purple days, yeah, I mean, that's, he wanted to be Robert Plant. So I could see how you would write a song to try and be just like your hero. It's funny when you watch, it's not In the Round. What's that first Def Leppard? It's a concert that they did from the early days, like maybe the High and Dry days. But anyway, Joe Elliott is on stage and he is doing all the Robert Plant moves. He's got the head to one side. He's got the, you know, the little shake that he would do. But I mean, mm-hmm. that's everybody wanted it. Once you saw Robert Plant, you're like, oh my God, I have to be. That's the way to do this. So you kind of just mold yourself into a version of that. And I don't know, like, it's kind of annoying because they say, yeah, David cover version or whatever. But like, wouldn't you be flattered in some way if you were Plant? Like, this guy just wanted to be like you. Like, you were that iconic to him that he basically wanted to have a career just like you. I don't know.
And when David started out in Deep Purple, he had dark brown hair, you know. And now it's the 80s and 90s. Now he's got the blonde hair, you know. Looking like, I mean, a lot of other bands did in the late 80s, that's for sure. So he's even looking like him. So you put him in a vest with no sleeves underneath it. You know, you give him the long blonde hair. You zoom back and it's like, yeah, maybe that is. You know, I get it. It's pretty obvious what the record company were trying to do with the videos and stuff like that. But his voice is different. Yeah, he can go up there and get those high notes and really hit those. But his bluesy, raspy thing.
That's where he's the best. Yeah, to me, that's where he's the best. When he's not trying to be anybody else, just sing the way that you can do it and let that kind of be your legacy.
That's right. That's right. All right, so the 10th song on the record is Absolution Blues. It's apparently the first song that they wrote together. It starts very slowly and ominously until then Jimmy picks up the pace, and then the drums come in, right? Boom, and now we're off and running. Hmm. Who's singing backup on this? I don't know. A couple guys named John Sambataro and Tommy Funderburk. But it's weird to hear other voices on it. And one of them sounds like, at first I'm like, well, maybe they got a woman singing on here because there's a little high on one of those.
Yeah. You know? I find it odd that you call this thing Absolution Blues and then it gets going pretty fast. Like usually blues are, you know, up so low, my little girl left me, boom, 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 boom. But this is not that. This gets going pretty quick.
And it also becomes a little bit epic, right? Because in the middle there, you've got that kind of droning guitar sound over the machine gun drum beat before you get to the solo, which is, you know, he's attempted at putting some epicness into this song. Mm-hmm. It just isn't epic. I mean, it's a decent hard rock blues song, the kind you want to make with David Coverdale, but it's not great to me. I think the riff is fine. I bet it was fun to play live, and they opened their set with it, it looks like. So they must have had confidence in it or like playing it. So, not my favorite. I mean, it's the first one. It's very rare that the first song you ever write together is fantastic. You got to get to know each other a little bit first.
Well, and especially, too, when they didn't – I don't think they had that much time in between when they met and when they put this record together. So you're right. I mean, it's just, you know, something –
I don't know. They had 2 years, right? I mean, two years.
Was it 2 years?
Yeah. I mean, they got together in 1991 and then over time. Now, and Jimmy's got stuff to do. I know he's busy being Jimmy, but, I mean, this comes out at three different dates, right? March 15th, 1993, Europe. March 16th, 1993, North America. March 18th, 1993, Japan. But, yeah, I mean, they had 2 years to put it together. Also, I heard that they only wanted to use analog stuff. They didn't want to go the digital route because that was more the Zeppelin, Whitesnake, you know, philosophy. Yeah. So maybe that, and Jimmy's just, I mean, you know, he's hard to deal with. I mean, I know that they had, he and David produced the album. I think a guy named Mike Fraser, who was being their engineer, eventually also got producer credit. But, you know, Jimmy's always going to produce it. So, you know, he can fiddle with it all he wants. And sometimes if you have all the time in the world, that's not good. Seriously. The art suffers because,
insane, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You can change it. Oh, what if I tweak it? Just like, but if you've like you've got one day to go and do the overdub, okay, go and do the overdub, and then do it the best you can, and then that's it. It's on wax, you know. So having a huge budget and all the time in the world is actually sometimes a negative thing.
So he was probably better off not recording the Zeppelin stuff on digital, or he'd still be there.
Maybe, maybe so.
Because that's what I've heard. At least when you have the tape, it's an end point. Like, we're done with this tape. You either have to get a new one, which you pay for, or work with what you've got. And a lot of times they just say, that's it. We're not spending any more money on tape. Go and mix what you've got. But digital, we could record this a million more times.
Yeah. It's a billion different directions you can go. Yeah. All right. Now, then we come to the penultimate track, number 11, Whisper a Prayer for the Dying. I've forgotten about this, but I don't know how many times we listened to this record all the way through. My guess is we listened to the first five songs quite a bit, and then we would take it out and play something else, or we'd skip on the five CD changer to the next CD, whatever. But this is better than I remember it. It's weird, but it's kind of a cool way to end the record. Look, I love the opening. It could almost be an Iron Maiden kind of opening. And in fact, he even says Stranger in a Strange Land during the first, you know, minute and a half, whatever it is. So it's better than Absolution Blues. I mean, it's mellow and ominous, but then it has this uplifting bit before you get to like the heavy metal part, you know, because this has a lot of different things going on in it.
And it's the beginning part. I love the first minute and change where he's just plucking the guitar.
Yeah.
And the lyrics, if you listen to it, are pretty heavy duty. It's a lot of the Gulf War stuff, images that they're putting in about how, you know, you're in the jungle or you're in the desert and you're dying and people are, you know, why are you there? They're lying to you as far as why you're in this spot. And mm-hmm. so to get that from Coverdale, like, that's a interesting social commentary you're making in 1993. Yeah. And then that part stops. And
right.
then you go into something totally different. And then he's just screaming at you.
That's the thing. He's like, he is screaming. He's really high here. He couldn't do this one today. Reports are David's voice is a little bit shot. And when he tours Whitesnake or whatever, they have to tune down a little bit. And
okay.
He can't quite do it. And so there's no way he could do this one today. And then the keys come in and change it a little bit.
Yeah.
There's some keyboard there. And now I'm like, okay, now there's like too much going on. Like, I like the shift in doing a couple different things. Now it's like, they're trying to be too many things here. And I don't think they played it because this would have been hard to pull off live.
Yeah. And I wonder too, if the message in there was not something they wanted to really push that hard. And yeah, this is a weird song. There's a lot going on here. And it's weird because it's at the end of the record. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, is that last spot, is it for something that's really going to anchor it or for something that's like, well, we've got it, but let's put it at the end. Like you said, I don't think a lot of people are going to make it through this record all the way through. You're a stranger in a strange land. The soothing words of politicians, those bodyguards of lies. Forgotten angels waste their time and hear the mother cries.
Yeah, and it fades out too. So mm-hmm. it's like, okay, now it's just kind of over. But there's this part was going, dying, dying. It sounds just like Robert Plant going, yeah. crying, crying. I mean, it sounds exactly like it, you know. So you can't get away from that, David. I mean, you just can't. You sound too much like Robert, and people know those songs too well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some of the songs that didn't make it on, there's a song called Saccharin, and you can get it on YouTube.
Okay.
And it's pretty well finished. It could have been on this album. There's a song called Good Love out there, too, that you can also find on YouTube, which are from these sessions. But there was and that may have been repurposed by David, because there was a few songs that, you know, a couple of them made it on Whitesnake's 1997 album, Restless Heart, Woman Trouble Blues, and Take Me Back Again, which may have started as other things.
Mm.
And just a few years ago, they put out Flesh and Blood. There's a song called Gonna Be All Right that I guess was part of it. There's a song from his 2000 solo album, River Song was the name of it. So some of this, you know, may have been repurposed, stuff like that. Plus, like I said, there's some shorter versions for single edits and things like that. There's apparently a few different versions of Take a Look at Yourself. So it seems to me that they could remaster the original. It sounds like they've got plenty for a second disc full of outtakes, you know, songs that weren't finished, all that kind of stuff. And then you want to put in a DVD or CDs of one of the live shows in the Budokan.
Mm-hmm.
That would be awesome. And a DVD would be amazing to see Jimmy and Guy playing together. I don't think you'll see that anywhere else.
Yeah, I wonder what the quality is on that video. But even if it was rough, just to see that, because, you know, like we said, they never made it to the United States. So there's nobody here that saw them play live. To see those Japan shows in whatever condition they're in would be great, because it just wasn't something that was readily available.
Right, you know, and Jimmy just, he hadn't toured a ton, right? He did the ARMS tour, which is a small tour in the early 80s with all the other legends. And
mm-hmm.
you know, he would have two or three songs on stage, and that was it. The Firm did some tours, but they weren't ginormous tours. I think they did good tours. His Jimmy Page Outrider tour didn't do very well. I know they canceled the show in Louisville. I think they canceled some of the other shows along the way. So Jimmy wasn't playing live much. And just to have something from that time, I think, would be incredible. So I am very, very hopeful. The thing is, if it were coming, I feel like they would pre-announce it by now. I mean, especially if it was going to come around the date of release, like in mid-March or something like that. Maybe it's something we'll get by the end of the year. And, you know, obviously there's going to be problems with rights to the Whitesnake songs and rights to the Zeppelin songs and all that kind of stuff. But I'm very hopeful because I would buy it. I would buy the deluxe version of this thing.
Yeah, I would too. Absolutely.
That would substitute the fact that we never got to see them and we traded our tickets in because we needed the 3250 or whatever it was. I would die to still have that ticket stuff. Yeah. I know. We should have just said, here's the money back. Can you just like stamp it or, you know, put a punch hole through it or something like that? So we can't try to get our money back again, but we can keep the souvenir.
Huh.
We should have tried that anyway, but I don't, it's too late now, baby.
The one thing I will say is that I know Coverdale is very hip to putting out everything again. Like he's got deluxe versions of the 87 record, Slip of the Tongue. So him doing that would not be out of the question.
Yeah, and they did, for all what I understand, and I don't own them, but I'd like to. In the last few years, he put out like three separate Whitesnake greatest hits. Like it was Red, White, and Blue. And like the blue was the blues. Like here's the blues songs. I mean, like the Bernie Marsden early stuff from Whitesnake. But it's from their whole collection. And, you know, and they had the rockers. And then I think they had maybe one that was like ballads or, you know, songs. Slower. Yeah, the love songs, you know. And for what I've heard, they're all been very well reviewed and people really dig them. So that is a great place for people to start with Whitesnake. Of course, David's like, I would work with Jimmy again in a minute. I think Jimmy, he is older, obviously. He's like 78, maybe getting close to 79 now. I don't see him touring with David. I just don't see that happening. But you never know, I guess. And they could rework a couple, maybe put together a couple new things to put on there for the re-release. It seems to me that they could do, you know, they could just do a straight remaster re-release. They could do a remaster with a second disc that has, you know, the lost tracks and the single stuff like that. And then you could also do the DVD version that has the Japan stuff on there, maybe a 4-disc version or something like that. And I would buy that. I would totally pick that up because it would be a great souvenir for this time that we, you know, we kind of missed out on. Because after this, look, that was it. They did the Japan thing. The American tour didn't work out. And then Jimmy, you know, look, Jimmy's got options. And Jimmy got the opportunity to go back and do something with Robert, which he did, which was highly successful.
I was going to say that while the Coverdale Page tour did not sell out the Orlando Arena, Landon Page did. No problem. There was not a seat left at that place.
That's for sure. You know, and it was amazing. And I remember thinking that while we were sitting in the arena, like, this is great. Like, it would have been cool to see Coverdale Page here, like, less than a year before. But it's not nearly the same as being here to hear these reworked Zeppelin tracks with an orchestra, with that killer band that they had. It was special. So, yeah, strange moment in time. And I guess it's got a special place in our hearts because we live together and live through it and we're trying to see them live and are just such huge Jimmy Page fans. Like, at least our dream of seeing him in person came true.
Right. And I think it really kind of put him back on the map of mainstream rock because, like you said, he did work with Puff Daddy and he was in the, not only did he use the track, he was in the video too. So it was, like you said, hip hop guys who had never seen Jimmy Page before was there. And then he worked with the Black Crowes for a while in the early 2000s, I guess that I did a little reading on that. That turned into a disaster thanks to the Robinson Brothers. But
I avoided that. I still haven't listened to that. The Live at the Greek thing with him. I just avoided it. You know, even though, look, I don't like the Black Crowes, but I gained a lot of respect for them after I saw them live. Like they're a pretty killer live band. I saw them open for the Dead in 1995. I don't like Chris Robinson as a person. I don't love the sound of his voice. Rich has got some good riffs, sure. But there's a lot of people out there with good riffs. So I just always avoided it. I'll tell you another one I avoided, and I probably ought to give it a chance, is walking into Clarksdale.
Okay.
Because after Jimmy and Robert had this big unleaded, the album, the VHS and the DVD sold very well. They all went platinum. Then they did a tour that went very well. Then they did the Walking into Clarksdale record, which to this day I've never picked up. But I saw them on that tour because the second tour they did, although the first one we saw was them with a band of 10 or 12 people, plus an orchestra for some bits. The second tour is basically Led Zeppelin. It's like 4 people on stage, maybe a fifth at some point. But, you know, they're basically doing a Led Zeppelin kind of show. I saw that with Emerson in Jacksonville.
Was that new stuff? Walking into Clarksdale, or was that reworked?
It was new stuff, and okay. That's why I didn't get it. Okay, I just kind of wanted to keep them in their place, right?
Yeah, and they had knocked it out of the park with that Unleaded, where it was, you know, songs that you knew, but they reworked them, so they were updated a little bit, and they were kind of, this was the version that we were used to. But yeah, I remember when Walking to Clarksdale came out, and it might be worth to go back and listen to it now.
Exactly. And I've done that for years. I'm like, well, look, if I listen to it and I love it, then I'm going to listen to the hell out of it. If I listen to it, I don't like it, I'm going to be disappointed. But if I don't listen to it, it'll have time to grow. You know, In the ether, I'll be like thinking, well, I've still got this I can go back and listen to. Like, I may have heard every Beatles album and every Beatles song, but if I really like sat down and listened to every single one of them over and over again, like I have some of the albums that I love, I haven't. And part of that's because I want to have something that I can fall back on and still be able to learn and listen. So
yeah,
that's what I've been kind of waiting to do on Walking to Clarksdale. But yeah, no, it got Jimmy working again. He didn't do much throughout the 80s and the early 90s until this. And then he did Unleaded. He did the tour. He did Walking to Clarksdale. He did the next tour. He did the thing with the Black Crowes. He did the thing with Puff Daddy. You know, he was viable again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it probably turned a lot of people back on to Led Zeppelin who were, or even introduced it to them, who was too young to even have any kind of connection to the original stuff. And I think to this day, he still lives on through these projects. I mean, I remember when that Black Crowes thing came out, and there were a lot of people who were younger than I was who were into it because of that. And it was like, right. Yeah, this, if you like this, go back and listen to the original. You will not be disappointed.
Well, that is me and Jackson and our take on Coverdale Page, the 1993 collaboration from the two legends of rock and roll, Jimmy Page and David Coverdale. Did we love it? Yeah, maybe not. Did we hate it? Definitely not. There is some great stuff in there. Overall, look, we're huge Jimmy Page, huge Led Zeppelin fans. We like Whitesnake a lot. David Coverdale's done a lot of things over the years that we like. So when this came out in 1993, when we were in college, we were hoping to see anything from Jimmy Page again. Didn't think a Led Zeppelin reunion would ever happen. Of course, now we don't think it really should. But we were psyched to get this. And there's some good stuff on this. And it was popular. It was on the radio. It's a platinum seller. The tour may not have really taken off in America. We did have tickets. We did trade them in. But now that it's 30 years old, we look back at it. Yes, some of it we like, some of it we don't. But I'm still glad it happened. And it really set up the reunion between Jimmy Page and Robert Plant in 1994 for the big Unleaded album and video and tour and more things after that. So a moment in time that's special to us, maybe they'll do a special 30th anniversary edition. We'll see. Time will tell. Not going to be a long postmortem here, guys, because I'm trying to make a big move across continents, trying to get back to my home in America. So as usual, we want to know, did we get something right? Did we get something wrong? Did we miss the point? Did we leave out your favorite part? You have got to let us know. You can email us, uglyamericanwerewolf@gmail.com, tweet or DM us at ugly_werewolf or at actionjack72 on Twitter. We're on Instagram. I think we might be on Facebook. We're definitely on YouTube, but we don't have a huge following. So if you want to check us out and follow us, that would mean a lot to us. Just please download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, be it Apple, Spotify, Podbean, Good Pods, wherever you might go. And if you think about it, please give us a positive review. It just helps us find more rock and rollers like you. And we want to thank Pantheon Pods for making us part of their family. We want to thank our incredible sponsors, RareVinyl.com. And if you use the code podcast, go to RareVinyl.com. You can save 10% off your orders. So maybe you want one of those European Coverdale Page singles. You can probably find it at RareVinyl.com. Can't tell you what's coming next week because I don't know where in the world I'm going to be over the next week. I just hope that we can get a show out to you. So you'll have to tune in to see what we're up to. But to all of you rockers all around the world, be cool and stay safe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.